when I showed up here on January 10th of 2008 looking for help. I went into that room over there and went to a meeting. A couple days, about 3 days later, I decided to ask the guy chairing the meeting in there at 12:15, which was Chris, to be my sponsor, mainly because he was jovial, he was knowledgeable and friendly, and he mentioned that he went to church, and so I felt like that was as good as a group of criteria that I needed to find somebody I kind of identified with. And 11 months later, I got sober. No reflection on him. He's still my sponsor. So with that, I'd like to introduce Chris. Yeah. Woo, Chris. Yeah.
Thank you, Joe. Joe, since that day, he has followed directions to the T. I asked him to call me every day, which he has, and sometimes I actually answer the phone. Yeah, sometimes I do. So, anyway, here I am. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I got the fellowship of the program. I've been sober since July 24th, 1999, so 2 weeks short of 17 years, and I'm grateful for that. I sobered up in this very room. Yay! That very room when we used to smoke weed. Glad to be here. You know, my sponsor told me years ago I need to come every couple of years, and not just to speak, but to apologize for everything I said last time. Because it's all changed, right? It's all changed. So I apologize for last time I was here. None of that's true anymore. So the other thing I learned is it's important to butter up the crowd first before you get started. So I've got a couple of gifts here. Right? One is our friend Brett M. has a new CD out, Long Live a Country Song. I've got an autographed version of that CD here. Here's some of the songs. Watching You Drink. Drinking Might Lead to Dancing. Whiskey River. When White People Drink Tequila. All right. This is Brett's CD, autographed copy. Who wants one of these? Good luck. All right, yes, it's the first time I saw this over here. All right. There you go, there's Brett's CD. And here's mine. Chris Estes, the Chris Estes Band by the Chris Estes Band featuring Chris Estes. I, self, and me, right? And a couple of tracks on here include Lord, We Lift Your Name Up, Praise to Our God and King, right? Who wants this?
I bought one. Thank
you. All right.
Good stuff. Yeah.
Very good, yeah. You know, to that end, I usually spent Sunday mornings in a church somewhere. For years, I was at a non-denominational megachurch where I was the lead guitar player. You know, lights and sirens and big screens and bookstores and all that. You know, you go answer the altar call, they take you out back and take your credit card imprint, that kind of place, right? So I did that for years. So it used to be I'd be more comfortable if everybody would listen to my talk standing up and going like this and saying amen a lot. But it would make me feel more comfortable. But now it's different. Now I'm at a large denominational church where I actually get the opportunity to speak from time to time. And I think what would make me feel more at home is if you would not pay attention to me and kind of look at your phone the whole time. Do a little texting, yawn, and look at your watch. That would be bad. I'd feel right at home at that point. All right. If you're new, I'd like to welcome you. And I hope I say something here that touches you, something that you can relate to, and whatever I say. I hope there's something, some nugget in what I say that helps you to see that you're in a room full of people, that whatever you're going through, whatever thoughts you're having, whatever nonsense that you've had to deal with, that you'll know that you're in a room full of people who can say, yes, me too. Right? Mm-hmm. We're not going to tell you what to do. We're going to tell you what we do. And we understand, not because we read it in a book, but we understand because we've gone through it as well. So welcome if you're new. And if you've been around for a while, or we haven't seen you in a while, welcome. We're glad you're here. So, all right, as I like to, let me refer to the 12 steps to delivering an AA, effective AA talk here that I like to bring with me. Just make sure I stay on point here, dress appropriately, respectfully. I was here on time. Good. Read the newcomers. All right. Now I will share a brief overview of my family background. I grew up in upstate New York, and I was born in 1961. fact, I think I was born, actually what happened was this, is that my parents were in a bar when she went into labor. So, maybe that's telling, I guess. And I grew up in poor dad. Dad's still a mild drunk to this day, and my mother's an undercovered Al-Anon. And so we've got to come from a long line of that, so I'm used to that. That would make me an adult child of an alcoholic. So I grew up in upstate New York. It was just a normal, pretty much, middle-class 1960s, 1970s upbringing. I don't recall anything particularly traumatic in my growing up, but I do recall this. When I was in eighth grade, I took my first drink. And I do remember this before then. I seem to walk around life from the time I was a little guy with knots in my stomach and squirrels running around in my head. I did for as long as I remember. I was a nervous wreck. And still am to some extent today, but certainly then. And I discovered a way to medicate that when I was 13 years old. And some friends and I around a bonfire, drinking Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill Wine and Dick Piper Slow Gin.
Oh,
right. That was 42 years ago. I just told you what brand I drank.
Yeah.
I don't know what I had for lunch yesterday. Right? I might be an alcoholic, right? You might be an alcoholic if you can tell us what was the first brand you drank was. But I can also tell you what it did. It made me puke, right? But that was later. What it did was this, and it did this for a long time. It did this from the time I was 13 till I was 38. I took that first drink and I went like this. Sweet relief, right? Sweet relief. If you're an alcoholic, you can probably relate to that. Sweet relief. Kind of untied the knots in my stomach, kind of slowed those squirrels down, and it worked. It worked for a long time until it could work. So I drank through high school. Fortunately, the drinking age was 18. Fortunately or unfortunately, the drinking age was 18 in New York State, so it was really easy. The driver's licenses didn't have photos on it. So from the time I was 15, I was Dave Roach. He was the guy. Reading his driver's license, I had a copy. And I was a bar drinker from the time I was 15, 16 years old. And it worked. It always worked. And it was accepted around my house. The thing about having an alcoholic dad, he's a drinking buddy, it was helpful. I remember getting ready for the senior prom, had my friend with me. I was wearing my powder blue, 100% polyester tuxedo, getting ready to go to the prom, and sitting with Dad, and we're drinking black velvet and ginger ale, okay? Kind of like rye and ginger. And Dad's giving us a talk, sharing some knowledge with us. I'm 17 years old, about to drive his car to the senior prom. He says, "Boys, don't mix the grape and the grain." I said, "What? Don't mix the grape and the grain tonight. What's that mean?" He said, "Well, what you're drinking here, black velvet and ginger ale, that's made from grain, right? That's grain to make whiskey, I see. All right, wine is made out of grapes. If you mix them, then you get hammered too fast, right? But if you just drink one or the other, you won't get as hammered as fast." "All right, Dad, thanks." Now normally when your 17-year-old's gonna go to the prom and ride your car, you're gonna say, "Boys, don't drink and drive," right? You're in trouble. But I mean, it was accepted around my house, so it was all right. All right. So then I went off to college and continued. And my nickname in college was Juice. And it's not because I ran the football like O.J. Simpson. I went to Oswego State, the Harvard of upstate New York, right on Lake Ontario. And I had a good college career. I actually got good grades, and I was very active. I was vice president of the student government, and that was it was nice. Nice thing about going to like a state school like that you can do good in school, and you can do good with the extracurricular activities, and you can drink every single day, right, and get away with it. It's good. It was really the high Ivy League standard, so that was convenient for me, and it worked. And after college, I moved to Texas. Then I got into the business that I'm still into this day, the outdoor advertising business. We're involved with billboards. I had an uncle, my rich Uncle Dick, who got me involved in the business and sent me down here to work for some people. and started my career here in Texas. And all the time, you know, I'm drinking the whole time, and it just really hasn't had much effect. It has not been a problem. Got married, my wife Pat, who manages the Al-Anon office here. She's the one in traditions here, where it says, number 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Managing the Al-Anon office. Met her, we moved to Miami, and continued the business there. Moved back here to San Antonio, started managing the business I used to work for here. And yeah, I had a successful business career, and all the while, you know, drinking like an alcoholic. And it was when we came back here, and it was in the early 90s, I started having troubles. I started playing in a bar band, and here, and right down the street from my house. And I mean, it got to be, you know, first it just started every weekend, every Friday and Saturday night. After a while, Thursday night started, then Sunday night, and it was more and more and more. And, you know, what I thought in my head I was doing was, you know, developing my musical skills and my musical career and what have you. But really, when you're playing a bar band, where are you playing? Bars, right? And what goes on in those places, right? Alcoholic drinking for the most part. So, I mean, it seemed like normal what I was doing, you know, because I'm developing my profession here while I'm participating in all this in bar world. And so it started progressing and it started getting worse and I started drinking more and more. And then I started my wine phase. You know, I became a wine collector. I decided that, you know, I could be more, I could probably be more refined if I did that. And that worked out for a while. I liked that there was a wine broker here that I would buy wine from, and I liked him because he had two different rooms. One room was for the collectible stuff, right? And the other room was for the everyday drinking red and the everyday drinking wine, white. And that was good because that implied that it was okay to drink wine every day, right? You know, he's got a whole room devoted to that. And so I did that. I did that. And during that wine phase, you know, I learned some tricks. Like before the wife comes home from work, and you be sure to have a glass of wine full for her and for you on the table. And that way that masks the fact that I had just drank a whole bottle before she got there, right? And so I learned that trick then. She started to notice there was troubles when the wine broker started making deliveries to the house. They just go to the door, and Ms. Estes says, here's Mr. Estes' delivery. Delivery of what? Oh, this wine from the great wine company. Oh, I see we're getting it delivered. All right. We're bringing it in. So it's one box. And he says, I'll be right back. And goes to the brings in a hand truck with three of them. So you know, that where that progressed to was this. And I started having panic attacks on airplanes, in the back seats of cars, and on the inside seats of booths and restaurants. And that was a problem because my job at that time was to get in airplanes and fly to cities and go ride in cars with people and buy billboards for people. And then sometimes I had to go to lunch with clients who would sit on the outside seats and I would sit on the inside seat. So that was a problem in three different ways where all this stuff was happening to me. So my life was one big walking panic attack. And so I started the rounds of psychiatrists, psychologists, and pharmacists at that point, you know, to deal with that. And we're drinking the whole time. And it just, it wasn't working. I was getting worse. And the knot was still in my stomach, and the squirrel was still in my head. And it wouldn't go away. The psychiatry wasn't working, the psychology wasn't working, the pharmacy wasn't working. There's nothing worse than drinking on top of taking anti-anxiety medication. I mean, it just doesn't work very well. And so I did that for quite a while. And finally, I couldn't stand it anymore. And I got to where I was afraid to leave the house, and you know, lest I have a panic attack. The business had been successful. In fact, we had sold it, and I had some money. And the problem with giving a drunk money is that then he can drink more, right? And so my life had kind of turned into where that's pretty much what I was doing. I was playing in the bar band and drinking, and it was a problem. And so, you know, one day, and I said, here's my bottom. You know, your bottom might have been a little more bad than this. I would imagine it probably was. But my bottom was this. I was laying on the couch watching the Travel Channel. Actually, I was drinking wine. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday. And watching the Travel Channel laying on the couch. So, all right, well, where are they going? To the Piedmont of Italy. Well, that's nice. I always wanted to go to the Piedmont of Italy. But I can't do that because I'd have a panic attack on the airplane. I couldn't possibly fly that far. Well, I probably have some wine of the region here. So I went and looked, and sure enough, I did. A bottle of Barbaresco from the Piedmont in Italy. So that was great. So I got my big wine glass and filled it up and with Barbaresco. Said, all right, well, this is, I can't go there, but this is kind of like being there. You know, watching it on the Travel Channel, drinking wine of the region. Thank God for cable television, right? You know, I can really experience this. And I thought, you know, this is freaking crazy. This is just insane. This is what my life has gotten to. I mean, this small where I can't even see the world. I can't do anything. I can just stay here and drink. I mean, something's got to change. Something has to change. So, the next day, I went and I played a gig Friday night. I got up the next day, and I decided that I had to do something about my drinking. And then I didn't know what. And I had to get my life in order, and I didn't know how. And so I thought about it, and I realized that I needed some kind of spiritual something needed now. And going to the Catholic Church with my wife just wasn't doing it for me. So I ran off to the Christian bookstore and I bought the Big Book of American Denominations. And I started on a Saturday morning reading through it. Okay. African American Anglican. That might be for me. No, probably not. Dad, what do Presbyterians believe in? Oh, nothing? Okay. But I picked up the phone and I called Methodist. All right, I called my friend Mike, my business partner Mike, who had, been concerned about my drinking for a while. And I called Mike, what do Methodists believe in? He said, well, why do you want to know? I said, well, I think I need some sort of spiritual thing happen to get my head straightened out. He says, I tell you what, I've got somebody here and I want you to talk to her. I said, oh, okay. So he puts this woman on the phone, and her name was Lisa. And she starts talking to me. And she had panic attacks, and she was depressed, and she was seeing psychiatrists and psychologists and pharmacists. And she had spiritual questions, and she was a drunk, and she couldn't stop drinking. And she was talking to me, talking my language. It was like I kept looking at the phone, you know, kind of like it's a mirror, like, I don't know why we do this, but it was like I was talking to myself, you know? And she had, you know, what Bill Wilson later calls all the drunkard's nightmares and etc. And she was speaking my language, and it was the first time I'd ever really talked to anybody like that. And she had a solution. And what had happened to her is she had 2.5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that intrigued me. So she put my friend Mike back on the phone, and he suggested I call a guy named Bill D. Now, Bill D sobered up, I think, in 1955 or so in New York City. And he lived in San Antonio at the time. And I had known him from business for 12 years. I had drank in front of this guy, played golf with him, and I knew he didn't drink, right? But I didn't know much more about that. And he never said anything about my drinking to me, ever. Right? And never. But Mike suggested I call him. And I knew he didn't drink, and I knew he had some kind of spiritual program. And so I called him up, and I said, Bill, this is Chris. I think the party's over. Right? Now, this guy never mentioned anything about my drinking in 12 years that I knew him. Right? But I think the party's over. And he says, oh, I've been waiting for your call. Right? See, he'd seen a few clowns like me, you know, between 1955 and 1999. And he knew, you know, what good was it going to do to start trying to evangelize me about anything. I mean, he knew it wasn't going to do any good. But he made sure I had his phone number. He made sure that Mike had his number. He made sure Mike knew that when it was my day, that Mike directed him to call Bill, which I did. And so I called Bill, and he'd been waiting for my call. And so what he did was he invited me to go out some sort of meeting at this place called Club 12, which I hadn't heard of. He said, oh, why don't you come over, we'll have a little meeting with some guys, and then we'll go out to dinner. I said, all right, great. Meet me at this place Monday at 5:30. So what I thought I was doing was going to, you know, out with some guys to like a businessman's lunch club, you know, kind of like the top of the Frost Bank building, you know, Club 12, Club, whatever that is. You know, and, you know, we talk about Chris's problem, we come up with solutions. So, you know, I show up here, and, you know, there's businessmen in here, right? And you can buy lunch. This isn't exactly a businessman's lunch club, is it? All right, so we get here and go right in there to the meeting. And, you know, I realize, okay, I'll talk some mountains. I get it. All right, I see what this is. You know, I'm real sure what that was. I'd seen some movies, right? And really my impression of what AA was about beforehand, even though I'd seen some movies, was like you'd go in here and get scared straight or something, right? Well, let's watch film strips of guys with big livers say, this could be you, you know? And that's not what I found here very much. And so anyway, I went right in that room for the first meeting, and they gave me a desire chip, and I don't remember a lot about the meeting. I remember what Bill D said. He said that if you're new, it had been his experience, and he had a lot of it, is that every single person he'd ever seen that got into AA had arrived here as the result of the prayers of somebody, you know, a wife or a husband or a mother or father or son or daughter or judge or pastor or somebody. And and I found that to be true later. I discovered that to be true. And I remember this also. The woman sitting next to me, hippie Wendy, she said this. She said that she had been told and she learned to listen for the similarities, not the differences. Listen for the similarities, not the differences. And that was helpful. Because I could have easily differenced myself out of there immediately. You know, easily. I mean, I did not live under a bridge. I did not have a DWI. You know, I was still married. I had my cats in my house and my car and my wife and my business. And so I could have easily differenced myself out. But I listened to the similarities. And the similarities were this. That I had this hole and you had this hole, right, that needed to be filled with something. And alcohol worked. Alcohol worked. But then alcohol started causing problems. And alcohol started to take over. And that was attractive. And you had a solution, and that was attractive. So anyway, she said that. She said, listen for the similarities, not the differences. I remember that. Then I stole her cigarettes. Right? I got home and I realized, oh man, I've got two packs of cigarettes here, and one must belong to that hippie lady that was sitting next to me. So I came back the next day to find her and to give her cigarettes and her lighter back. And when I did, I discovered there's something different about the people here. I gave her the cigarettes and the lighter back, and I said, God, I'm so sorry I stole your cigarettes from your lighter. And she said, that's all right, honey. I just figured whoever took them needed them. Like, you know, these people are different. These people are different. So, my very first week here, started going to the 10 o'clock meeting as well. There was a guy that came to that meeting every night. And he would say this, on his first day of sobriety, somebody had said to him, first thing in the morning, ask God to keep you sane and sober. And the last thing at night, thank God for a good day of sobriety, even if it sucks. And I started doing that the next day. And I've done that every day for 16 and a half years, and that seemed to have worked. And you know, everybody I know that does that, that just seems to work. So I remember before I tried that came to recovery, and I would try to like slow down or moderate or stop. And I eventually could. I remember this, though. You know, every time I asked God, please, God, help me not drink tonight, you know, he seemed to honor that prayer. That seemed to work, right? And I wouldn't drink that night. But whenever I said, God, don't let me drink too much tonight, that prayer never worked. Right? That never worked. And, I didn't understand why until I got here and got into this book and discovered, in the doctor's opinion, you know, men and women drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. Well, duh. You know, right? Restless, irritable, and discontent, till they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. You know that feeling. You know, drinks they see others taking with impunity, you know, with no consequence. You know, my wife would have a drink or two, and she'd get a little giddy, and she'd go to bed, you know. I'd have a drink or two, and I'd go to town, right? Really? Yeah. You know, once they succumb to the desire again, as so many do, you know, they start on a spree, emerging remorseful, a firm resolution not to do it again. It's repeated over and over again. And that was me. That was me. Remember once before coming here, I had people over for dinner. I had quit drinking. This was January 1999. I had the alcoholic hypochondria at the time. Anybody have that? You know, you get whatever disease you hear people get on TV. Oh God, I've got that. So you know, I thought for sure my pancreas was going at that point. So I went to the big book. I went to the bookstore and got, you know, medical diagnosis for dummies. You know, looked up pancreas. Said, don't drink. Okay, don't drink. All right, I quit drinking, damn it. So I quit drinking, or tried to, for the whole month of... I was going to quit drinking forever, that's what it was, beginning of January 1999. And I said, nah, I can't do that. Well, just for the month. I'm going to quit drinking for the month. And it was on the 22nd of that month, and I remember because like my wife's birthday. Had people over for dinner. Serving them wine. How about you, Chris? None for me. I don't drink this month. All right, great. I got a whiff of it, you know. All right, well, let me just take a... the nose. The legs. So beautiful. All right, I'm just going to take a sip. Just a sip. Right? If I take a sip, it was like a nuclear explosion in my head. I mean, it was like lights and sirens. It was beautiful. And then I swallowed it. It was even better, right? And so then I drank the rest of that glass, and I drank the rest of that bottle, and I drank three more. And that was the beginning of my blue period, which ended when I got here. And the doctor's opinion, you know, that laid it out right there. You know, because I was walking around. I was a dry drunk those 3 weeks. I was a mess. Irritable, restless, discontented. Pacing around the house. Until I took that drink, and then it was like, sweet relief. But then I couldn't stop. I tried to stop a lot. I remember one time. So I'm not drinking tonight, damn it. It's a Tuesday night. I had to be on an airplane the next day. Didn't want to be on it with a hangover. So I'm not drinking tonight. So what am I going to do? Pace around the house for a while. I know. I'll sit down and I'll watch television with my wife. That's what I'll do. So I sat down with her on the couch. I said, what's on? Oh, great. Lifetime Television for Women. Okay. Great. A drink will fix this, right? Out to the garage, open a beer, you know, two or three more, and then, you know, the movie's pretty good, you know? Not bad, you know, for a couple of cocktails. You know, it's funny, now you watch those movies, and it's all about, you know, some Al-Anon wife, you know, with a husband whose bed she's burning down, you know, with one husband. So anyway, so I show up here, and I discover there are people just like me, and they have a solution, although I wasn't sure what that was. You know, the first night I did, I kind of fought it a little bit. Bill took us out to dinner. It was me and two other guys whose names I don't remember, and then a guy named Danny M., better known as Dumpster Danny, Under the Bridge Danny, but he's got about 25 years now. And so we go out to dinner, we go to Los Barrios, and you know, all these guys, all they did was talk about themselves. You know, they tell their story. You know, like, how about me? You know, don't you want to hear from me a little bit? And these guys, you know, tell me their stories. Great. So when it was my turn to talk, you know, I pull my Ativan bottle out of my pocket and I show it to them. And I tell them my little tale of woe about how I'm a wine collector with emotional troubles under the care of professionals to deal with my type A personality. Right? So I listen to that for a while and don't roll their eyes too much. But, you know, this guy Danny's not doesn't seem like he's paying too much attention. So Bill asks him. Bill says, well, Danny, you know, what do you think? He looks up from his fajitas and says, this guy doesn't want to hear what I think. I said, well, sure I do. He says, I think you're boring, he says. Well, boring? What do you mean boring? He says, you're boring because you sound just like me. I said, just like you? What are you kidding? You lived under a bridge, you know? You know, you went to detox 18 times, is what you just told me. You drank Thunderbird red wine under the bridge. You know, you ate out of dumpsters. You worked at the plasma, right? Just like you, I'm boring. What do you mean? He says, yeah, you're just like me. You know, you think you're all these things—a wine collector, with businessman with emotional troubles, right? tell you what you really are. You're a wino crybaby who runs to his high-priced drug dealer every time he doesn't get his way. Right? Why is he being so mean to me? Why is she being so mean? Because it turned out that was true. You know? The next day I was talking to a friend on the phone that I grew up with who was in AA, and I was telling him about this AA Nazi that I had gone to dinner with. I said, yeah, I don't think he knows what he's talking about at all. He says, Chris, let me tell you something. You can't BS the BSers. He knows who you are, and he's telling you the truth. So I think that was step one for me. You know, I then getting in this book, that solidified it. But that was it for me. It was Danny. And he really helped me see that. So I've been here for about 4 or 5 days. And, I get there was steps. So I understood that. And then there was a book. I started to understand that. And then there was a guy in the meeting. And he'd say things like this. He'd say, then on page 64 it says blah, 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 blah. And, of course, on page 20 it says blah, 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 blah. And, the process yields the results, and it tells us that right here on page 50, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, all right, I have no clue what that guy's talking about, but I think he knows something about this book. And I had kind of put together in my mind that the steps had something to do with recovery, and the book had something to do with the steps. And this guy seemed to know the page numbers. So maybe I could ask him if he could help me with this book. Sir, could you help me understand this book? Right out here. And he said, what's your name? And I said, my name's Chris. And he said, all right, Clint. are you willing to go to any lengths? Whatever I tell you, if it doesn't hurt you. I said, I guess. All right, Cliff. That's what I want you to do. Well, this guy's nickname's Big Book, right? Big Book Dick. So he knows something about the book. He knows something about the book, and... the second part of his name means something too, I guess. he's been my sponsor since then. He is beautiful. He's just a beautiful man. Talk about listening to the similarities, not the differences. I've been married for 30 years this year. Big Book Dick's been married 13 times. Just once in sobriety. Big Book Dick was married to 3 women at the same time. Yes, indeed. Yeah. It was fun in early sobriety. It was a good thing my wife got a truck because my sponsor, I would move from one trailer park to another for the first couple of years of my sobriety, And anyway, God bless him. But you know what? He had what I wanted. He had a relationship with God that he knew how to stay sober, and he knew this book. So I was really grateful for that. And so I started doing what he told me, from day one. And I think he'll tell you, too, 17 years later, if he tells me I do it. And this is what I learned. Because my way wasn't working, and I tried all the ways. And it just was not working. I was starting to get relief here. And I'm going to take a little risk here. And instead of kind of doing it the way we do it sometimes and going through the steps, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to try this. Is that our level of consciousness and the level I understand things, has changed quite a bit from the time I first showed up here. And that kind of parallels some things I've been learning about. Our states of consciousness do evolve. And I'm going to try to tie my experience going through the program and my time here with that. There's kind of a consensus that's been come together with people kind of think of these things about the evolution of human consciousness and the evolution of societies and the evolution of personal consciousness. And it's called spiral dynamics. So I'm going to try to do this in that context. And you can ask me about it later if you want to. But when we get here, before we get here, we're at a place where it's what's called kind of archaic way of thinking. And really, all I was interested in was my next drink. If you think about somebody who needs their next hit of whatever drug it is, or their next drink, that's kind of all my focus at that point. Life gets really, really small. And that is what had happened to me. My life had gotten to where all I could really do was try to manage not having panic attacks. And the way I was doing that was by staying cloistered inside my house, just drinking at home, and that was it. My world had gotten really small. You know, then I showed up here and I discovered something. I discovered that people who had lived that way, my world started to open. You know, I started to see that I was powerless over alcohol, but there was a solution. You know, the solution was here. And it was beautiful, right? It's what they call the magical, mythical stage, where the world just starts to you start to see that there are forces beyond myself, right? That the step two, where I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. That there were, actually, there's a benevolent universe here and a benevolent God, who and sobriety was possible if I just kind of tapped into that. And that's kind of the pink cloud phase, you know, where like life is a double rainbow, right? It's like a double rainbow, man. It's like beautiful, you know, when you first get here, when you start to realize, wow, there are people just like me. I don't have to do this on my own, right? And there is a way out. God, this it is. It's beautiful. I love you, man. I love you. I love you, people. There's not a damn thing you can do about it, right? Ben Cartwright, my spiritual advisor, he would say, has anybody told you that they love you today? Well, I do. You know, so, you know, then I'm new and I start doing that to, like, women. Not a good idea. Awkward. Right? Awkward. Yeah. But life is beautiful. And there's these forces outside ourselves that that do affect things. You know, then the next phase I kind of went through was what they call the traditional stage. We have a book, and we do it by the book, because the book says to do it by the book, right? That's it. Read the black part, damn it, right? That's how we do it. If you want to bake a cake, you follow the recipe. If you don't follow the entire recipe, then you're not going to have a cake, you're going to have something else. Now, all these things are true, right? All these things are true. Absolutely, and there's health in all this. There's also dysfunction in all these things. Right? So, I went through my big book stage, that's for sure. You know, because I was, my nickname was Big Book Chris, Dick Chris, Big Book Chris, right? One time, somebody asked Pooh, you know, who's your husband? She said, Chris. Which Chris? Big Chris, the Dick, Big Chris with the turquoise. Forget it. Yeah. So I went through that, you know. I mean, I was the big book thumper of the best book. And, you know, I mean, I still have the thing memorized. One time, Dick and I were driving to Kennedy or somewhere to go to a meeting. And he and I, together, between the two of us, recited from memory not just the first part of chapter 5, but the entire chapter, right? The entire chapter. So, yeah, so I can thump the big book with the best book. I mean, you know, we go through that phase, and it's necessary. It's needed. We have to be rooted in what it is we're talking about and what this program of recovery is about. You know, the steps they took, which is not the entire program, I'll have you know, right? Arthur M. told me a long time ago, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is one drunk sharing his experience, strength, and hope with another drunk. I mean, that is the program, right? Because our tendency is to go to the next phase, right, which for a long time, Dr. Ray taught me this. I was in my administrative phase of recovery. You might know that phase. It's the phase when you're on every committee, right? It's the phase where, for me, I was chairing the 12:15 meeting, like, and the 10 o'clock meeting, and most of the 5:30 meetings, like, every day, you know, chairing all the meetings. And I was the GSR and the DCM, and then I was the chairman of SAMHSA. This was great. I was the chairman of SAMHSA, the inter-district. It was called the San Antonio Metropolitan Service Organization, whose entire function was to just make sure each district didn't have, you know, like a, do a workshop on the same day, and to sit down and have a meeting where it was coordinated. Well, everybody, for some reason, got to hating SAMHSA. And so I was chairman of the group club, group conscious at the time, group conscious, and I was chairman of SAMHSA at the same time. And we're having a special group conscious meeting. Because people wanted the club to not give money to SAMHSA anymore. So here I'm chairing a meeting where they're taking the money from the organization that I'm chairman of, right? And, you know. So I didn't know whether to vote yes or no or both, you know, myself. But, you know, so I lost, too. I mean, they voted, yeah, let's not give them any more money. And so that's the administrative phase where it's all about the programs that I'm part of. And I got to get real busy. And again, there's health in that. There is. It really, really works. I think the phase I'm in now is, what they call kind of the postmodern phase, I guess, or the green phase, where, you know what, man, however you do it, that's just fine with me, right? And here's my thought now, too. I don't know anything, right? And what is knowledge, anyway? Can we really know anything, right? That's kind of where I'm at now. And what I'm hoping I get to, and I hope we all get to, is kind of a second tier consciousness, one of more integral, one where I can realize that, wait a minute, inside of me and inside of every one of us, it's like a spiral. It's all, every one of those phases is in me right now, right? Sometimes I'm archaic. Sometimes I just need that next pepperoni pizza, right? And that's it. And I am focused on that thing, right? And sometimes the world is a double rainbow, man. It is just beautiful. And I can sit and I can just enjoy and I can just sense. And I don't even have to hear the words and the meaning. I can just hear the language of the heart. And I can just hear just even the cadence of the way people speak, right? And it speaks to me here and it heals me here, right? And then sometimes I can sit down with a newcomer and I can go through this book and we can go through one word at a time and you can see the light come up. Right? And you can say, hey, why don't you just try this right here? On page 84, it says, when we retire at night, on page 86, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Why don't you give this a try and see how that works? Right? And then sometimes I'll be part of something, right? I'll start something. I'll start a program. At Haven, I'm very involved, and I have been for 15 years, kind of in the Christian recovery movement as well. And if you want to talk about that at all, you can see me after the meeting, but started something a long time ago called the Pioneer Group, where we look at the biblical roots of the 12-step movement. And we have meetings that we discuss those sort of things. And I do that as a public service. That way there's not a whole handful of people or a whole group of people bothering everybody here with the Bible verses and meetings here, right? No, okay, do it in our meeting. That's fine. Don't do it here. Anyway, so sometimes you can start something like that and it really bears fruit and continue to do it. And it's been really good for me. We started doing that at Aim for Hope 4 years ago, and it's really turned out to be a real blessing. So sometimes that administrative phase is helping that as well. And then this phase of just the relativism of just realizing I know that I don't know, right? I just know that I don't know. I don't necessarily know what's right for you. You might not have to do it the way I do. A page they point to a lot is page 17. I like to point this out too. It says this: we have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. It doesn't say unison action, right? It says harmonious action, where we don't have to all do this thing the same way, right? I mean, it's like music. It's, if you have a piece of music and everybody's singing the same note, that just doesn't necessarily work. That's called unison. Everybody's singing the same note, and there's no variety and richness in that. Right? When you start having somebody sing the third and the fifth or the seventh or whatever in unison, in harmony, according to the music, then it gets interesting. Then it gets richer. And then it gets fuller. And then God speaks in a greater way in there. We're all on the same piece of music, right? All on the piece, but we might be singing a different part in harmony. So there's health in that. But here's the thing. When we get to this integral phase, we get to the phase, hopefully, where I can see all this in me and I can see all this in you, then I become more loving. Then I become more like my higher power. Then I become less judgmental. Then I become more of service to people. Then I become more of service to God and the people about, for sure. But the trick is this. My tendency is this, is to look back with disdain. I'll look at earlier places where I was, and I'll look back with disdain. I'll look at those big book thumpers, right? They are so narrow-minded and rigid. I want to avoid that. I want to not do that, and that is a tendency. The other thing is I don't want to look forward with fear. Look at those New Agers meditating, Chad, the next thing we're going to do is be worshiping dogs and cats. What's going on here? So if I can manage not to look back with disdain or forward with fear, I think that I can have a more integrated self. I can become closer to God, and I can be of more use to you and my fellows and to God as well. So that's what I'm hoping to do in my next phase of recovery. And I'm just grateful I have thousands of people in this town and millions of people across the world that I can share with and do that with. So, all right, I'm finished with this. I'm going to tell my turquoise story and why it is that I wear turquoise. And sometimes I wear a lot more and sometimes a lot less. But I was in that room on a Friday. It's my first Friday in recovery. And I'm sitting there during the whole meeting and I'm worried because that night I had to play a gig at a bar and I didn't know how I was going to stay sober. And so I came out here, I'm sitting in the big room right about here where Bill is, at the table by myself, and I'm dressed up in my gig clothes. I had a stage name. My stage name was Austin T. Healy. Right? Austin T. Healy, legend in my own mind. So I'm wearing my Austin T. Healy clothes, which included all the turquoise. Right? Some years before I decided I needed a look, and I saw a guy on the National Network and said, that's the look I want to achieve. Yeah, I was wearing all kinds of turquoise. So. Anyway, so I was wearing my turquoise and my Austin T. Healy clothes, and this woman comes out of there, her name was Francesca, and she was a very vibrant, right, jovial person, and kind of loud as well. And she comes out and she says, "Ow, I love your ring!"
Good.
She said, "Why are you dressed like this?" And I said, "Well, I'm wearing my gig clothes. I got to play a gig tonight at this. What are you playing?" And I told her, and she said, "Oh, I used to drink there. I'll come to the gig, and I'll bring my sponsor." My sponsor was Raymond F. And she said, "I'll bring my sponsor, and I will go to your gig." I said, "You'll do what?" She said, "Yeah, I'll go there." I said, "You'll go to the bar to the gig? Why?" She said, "Well, to make sure you don't drink, honey. That's what we do. That's what we do for each other, right?" I said, "Wow." And they did. They came to the gig, you know. And for the next 6 months, until I was done doing all that bar band stuff, they came, right? And they would sit there, and they'd dance some, and they would sit there, and they wouldn't drink. And they'd bring some other people from the fellowship. Crazy Lynn, God bless her. And others. And they would come, and they'd make sure that I wouldn't drink. And so I started wearing the turquoise and the beads and all this stuff shortly thereafter, all the time, as a reminder of the love that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you.
Awesome, dude.
Awesome.
Gotta stop this.